want to tell you a little bit about our guest because he has some fantastic credentials. Robert M. Schock, PhD, is a full-time faculty member in the areas of science and mathematics at the College of General Studies at Boston University. He's been there since 1984. He earned his PhD in geology and geophysics from Yale University. Since 1990, Dr. Schock has been researching the age of the Great Sphinx. Based on his geological studies, he's determined that the Sphinx's origins go back to pre-dynastic times, thousands of years older than previously thought. This research formed the basis of the Emmy-winning documentary, The Mystery of the Sphinx, in which Dr. Schock is featured and is also discussed in his book, Voices of the Rocks, A Scientist Looks at Catastrophes and Ancient Civilizations. In recent years, Dr. Schock has expanded his research to encompass pyramids and associated structures around the world, and that's the subject of his latest book, the one we're talking about tonight, Voyages of the Pyramid Builders, The True Origins of the Pyramids from Lost Egypt to Ancient America. Dr. Schock has lectured widely and is the author or co-author of numerous papers, reviews, abstracts, and several other books, including the textbook, Environmental Science, Systems and Solutions. In recognition of his geological and paleontological contributions, in 1993, the new genus Schockia, an extinct group of fossil mammals, was named in his honor. Dr. Schock, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Tell me, before we get into the pyramid talk, what is a Schockia? What is the new genus? I think it's great.
It's a group of animals that's now extinct, lived about 60 million or so years ago, and they were sort of cat-sized. I guess mm-hmm. the best way to think of them is like they weren't really cats, but to the average eye, they might have sort of looked like cats.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I thought that was sort of neat. Not everyone gets an animal named after them.
No, that's true. I've heard of people having stars named after them, but not animals named after them. Do we know, what part of the world were they in?
They lived in Western North America.
Oh, so they're sort of one of ours.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, very good. I'm fascinated in your background because you teach science and mathematics. You're a geologist.
Correct.
And yet you've gotten off into this wonderfully fascinating area of the Sphinx and the pyramids. How did you, was it a transition or do you do everything all at the same time?
Oh, I guess I sort of do everything all at the same time. I'm still a geologist. I still do other types of science. But mm-hmm. I've always been fascinated by ancient cultures and ancient civilization, even as a young child, decades ago. It doesn't seem strange to me to take scientific techniques, to take my background as a geologist and apply them to ancient monuments. After all, what we know of ancient cultures is very much tied up or wrapped up with their buildings, their structures, their stonework that has survived. So that's my, seems appropriate that geologists should look at such things in my mind.
Well, realistically, they built the structures out of stone, and that's what geologists study. And the thing that always struck me was how, in a way, flimsy and frail our own structures are, and then you look back to these ancient civilizations, regardless of which continent you're looking at, and these things have lasted for centuries and centuries. I mean,
exactly.
I, as you were and are, I have always been fascinated with Egypt and Central and South America, and with the main question of how did they do what they did,
and
how did they survive?
Exactly.
Did they know something we don't know?
It's a difficult question because it has many different levels. I think at some fundamental levels they did know things that we don't know. And I don't mean that in any kind of strange technological way. I think just sort of their philosophical outlook, their perspective on history, how they saw themselves relative to the cosmos was maybe different than the way we moderns tend to view ourselves. I think we tend to be very insular, very in the moment versus having a longer-term perspective on things, which I believe they tend to have.
In other words, they saw themselves as part of, if you will, eternity, and so they built these massive monuments to survive?
Exactly. I think because you look at some of these monuments, whether it's Egypt or Mesoamerica, and they are incredibly, we would say, overbuilt. You know, way more massive, way stronger. I mean, they're built to last, or, I mean, it's way beyond the function of the moment, should we say.
Yeah.
And we just don't necessarily put the time and effort into things like that.
Well, we tend to, especially I think in this country, and perhaps more out west, which is where I live, than Easterners. Certainly, mm-hmm. one of the failings of California was as soon as something got old, they tore it down and built something new.
Oh, absolutely.
And whereas back east, there is, or has been at least, a tendency to try to preserve old structures for the sake of history.
Exactly.
But we don't have anything that comes anywhere close to lasting.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's I don't know. I think it's just a very different mentality, if you would, back then.
You got interested in the Sphinx. And as I understand it, current knowledge is that it has a longer history than we ever dreamed. Give us an idea of how you got started getting interested in it and what you found out.
Okay, the Sphinx itself, which really was the, I've always been interested in ancient history and cultures, as I said, you know, since a very young age, but I got involved in the Sphinx very specifically due to John Anthony West, which, I'm sure, you and, some of your listeners know about his work in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And he first got me involved. Actually, one of these very circuitous things, he happened to know another faculty member at Boston University, and we were introduced, you know, sort of through mutual friends, that type of thing. And he got me first specifically interested in the Sphinx. At that time, the conventional dogma, if you would, or the traditional idea was that the Sphinx was carved out of the rock at Giza in Egypt, about 2500 BC. West wasn't sure if this was exactly the, you know, correct solution to the puzzle, because there's no documentary evidence, there's no inscriptions that say when the Sphinx was carved, when it was built. And he asked me to look at it as a geologist, and people before him, including 19th century Egyptologists, had questions about when the Sphinx was built, how old it was. But in the 20th century, it had sort of crystallized what was 2500 BC. I went and I looked at it, and what I found, based on my research, was that, in fact, there was a component of about 2500 BC to the Sphinx, but in fact, this structure had a much, much earlier history. And to get to the conclusion, the core structure, the oldest portions of the Sphinx, by my estimation, by my dating, goes back to at least 5,000 to 7,000 BC, maybe earlier.
Wow, that's a huge difference.
Exactly, exactly. And it's such a huge difference that it really says something important about what's going on the Giza Plateau. Where did Egypt come from? Because we're talking, in traditional terms, pre-dynastic Egypt, yet you've got this monumental structure going back, you know, potentially thousands of years before dynastic Egypt, which was unimaginable 10 years ago.
When you say that the oldest portion of it, are you saying that it was built in steps?
No, well, actually, it was sort of built in steps. I would say it was more built and recarved. So it gets a little complicated. For instance, everyone thinks of the Sphinx as being this recumbent lion, sitting on the plateau, it faces east, with the head of a human, head mm-hmm. of a man or woman, depending on your interpretation. In fact, that head, I've determined, is clearly not the original head. It's been recarved. Yeah, so that's a fourth, well, maybe not fourth dynasty, but it's a dynastic head, probably, by my best estimate, first or second dynasty, but
mm-hmm.
dynastic head, but it's not the original head, so that gets confusing right there. But the body, what I call the oldest portion, goes back much earlier. Then it was adopted by the dynastic Egyptians. They recarved the head, They modified it. They did some carving in the rear portions of it. So it's this structure. And if you look at Europe, medieval, modern-day Europe, you get the same type of thing where you do have nothing as old as the Sphinx, perhaps, but, you know, cathedrals that have been rebuilt, reused, taken over, in some cases, you know, turned from one purpose to another.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the Sphinx, when you say they recarved the head, do you mean that the stone is the original stone, but what it looks like changed, or did
Correct.
They in fact put another head on it?
It's interesting. That is original stone, but if you look at the Sphinx, and this is something that struck me the first time I ever went there, and I was not expecting it, the head of the Sphinx is too small proportionally for the body. And it's in different proportions to all other sphinxes known in ancient Egypt. The head is just too small for the body. And what I'm absolutely, you know, convinced is the case is that originally it had another head, which would have been in proportion to the body. I believe that became very heavily weathered and eroded over time. And they literally recarved it. So when you recarve it, it has to become smaller. Which is why
true.
It's too small for the body at this point. I mean, it doesn't look that bad if you're not thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean to belittle the Sphinx. It's a beautiful structure. But it, in fact, if you start looking and measuring and comparing the proportions, the head's too small. So yes, it's the original stone, but the surfaces have all been reworked.
Now, you said that it's different in terms of proportion from all of the other sphinxes
Egypt.
Where are there others, and what do they look like?
There are many sphinxes around Egypt from the Old Kingdom, later in the Old Kingdom. When I say Old Kingdom, 4th, 5th, 6th Dynasty.
Mm-hmm.
There are plenty of sphinxes from Middle New Kingdom times. Some of them are, you know, tens of feet long, nothing close to the Great Sphinx, which is, you know, several hundred feet long.
Mm-hmm.
But there are many sphinxes, both freestanding, carved as reliefs, etc. And if you look at all of these and measure the basic proportions, you know, head to body length, width of the face, relative to width of body, etc., they all fall pretty much within a canon, within common dimensions, except for the Great Sphinx.
Now, what about the theory that possibly wind and sand and erosion could have caused that difference in size?
Yeah, I've looked at that very carefully. In fact, that's been a major feature of my research, is looking at the erosion of the Sphinx. One thing that I determined, and this has since been confirmed, I'm happy to say, by independent geological research by other geologists who went out there, like I said, totally independent of me, is that the predominant features of erosion and weathering on the base of the Sphinx, on the body of the Sphinx, actually are due to, of all things, water, precipitation, rainfall, which
mm-hmm.
is interesting because of anyone that's been to Egypt knows that the Sphinx and the Giza Plateau and the pyramids, they sit on the edge of the Sahara Desert. So you don't get a lot of rain nowadays. But what you do get, if you go back geologically, is before about 3000 BC, you get a very different climatic conditions in that region. And those climatic conditions correlate with the type of erosional features you see on the oldest portions of the Sphinx. Again,
one other question before we get past it on the other sphinxes from the later dynasties.
Mm-hmm.
Are the heads on those the same as the head on the Great Sphinx?
Some of them are and some of them aren't. Classic sphinxes from other dynasties have humanoid heads, human heads.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you get heads that are very, very specifically, we can recognize them, that they're meant to be pharaohs, specific pharaohs. Sometimes they're more generic. Classic Egyptian Sphinx is a lion's body and a human head.
Right.
In some cases, you get variations on that theme. So you get sphinxes with ram's heads or sphinxes with what you could say is a lion's head but with human features on it. Mm-hmm. So it looks more lion-like, if you would.
Yeah.
And then that grades all the way into things that we would not call sphinxes, but are similar to sphinxes in the sense that they are recumbent lions, more or less lions' bodies with lions' heads.
Did they have any special significance that you're aware of?
Sphinxes?
Yeah.
They tended to serve as guardian-type statues or, you know, sort of represent guardian-type deities, sometimes associate with openings or closings in the sense of both in a literal sense and a metaphorical sense. So you'll see sphinxes lined up perhaps at the entrance to a temple,
mm-hmm.
or by the sides of a door. That's very common for them to occur in pairs. Some people have suggested on that basis that there must be a mate, if you would, to the Great Sphinx.
I was going to ask you that because, yeah. You know, when you see them, usually there are two of them and they look, you know, very formidable. Why would they build just one?
Just one. Well, that's a good question. Again, I think that the Great Sphinx is clearly the prototypical Sphinx, both in age and in what would have been the original proportion. Some people have suggested, and I'm not advocating this, that there's another Sphinx on the other side of the Giza Plateau, somewhere buried in the sand. The Great Sphinx that we know sits on the eastern portion of the Giza Plateau, where the three most famous pyramids in Egypt are,
mm-hmm.
And it faces east, basically faces the rising sun. Some people have suggested that maybe in terms of pairs and symmetry, there would be one on the other side facing west. I don't know of any actual material evidence for one. But on the other hand, in Egypt, you know, there's still a lot
possible
to learn and explore and discover.
And have they ever searched for it? I mean, I know that they found some of the new living areas around the pyramids,
right,
where they think that, you know, the workers lived, and they've just found some amazing things.
Oh, yeah.
After all these years.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Certainly possible that something could be buried in the sand.
Yeah, I would not say it's impossible. Has there been a systematic search for it? Not that I'm aware of. I mean, one thing that I and other people would like to do, I've done some geophysical studies around the Giza Plateau, and we found interesting things like a cavity under the left paw of the Sphinx that was unknown previously. I'd like to extend those studies someday to other areas, both around Giza Plateau, the Giza Plateau, and also in other parts of Egypt. So, you know, maybe we'll find something.
Well, that would be wonderful. Let's go back to this mysterious creature that's sitting there on the plateau. You mentioned the doing the geophysical studies and finding things inside of it. At this point of what we know, it was not something that people went into. It wasn't a building. But
no.
Then again, with what you're finding out, maybe it did have some other kind of purpose. We're at the bottom of the hour. We'll take a quick pause. And when we come back, we'll continue with my guest, Dr. Robert N. Schock. We're talking about the Sphinx and the pyramids in Egypt, and so much more, because they're all around the world. And how did they get there? We'll find out on Coast to Coast AM. I'm Barbara Simpson.